All right. Judges chapter 19 through 21. We're excited, right? I'm sure that all of us probably feel the same about the story and details that we're going to read this evening. This is a sobering account of God's people and the atrocities and the abominations that are committed in these chapters. I do think there are a lot of application that we can make from this, that we can learn from this at the very least, and see how quickly the people of God can deteriorate, can completely deteriorate. We've been talking this entire quarter about this downward spiral that the people have been on. Well, in Judges chapter 19 through 21, there's been a flush, right? I mean, this is the flush that you see of just they've completely gone down the spiral and hit absolute rock bottom, and it is sickening, it's disheartening, it's appalling. I mean, I could think of a lot of adjectives to describe this. It's almost like something out of some kind of modern psychological horror movie, some of the details that we read in these chapters. But, again, to kind of direct our study, there are a few questions that I've sent out. And I sent out more questions this time than normal because I wanted to be able to take the discussion in several different directions as we begin discussing and see where we're going to let the discussion lead, and hopefully we all get something out of this and learn a lesson from the mistakes of others. There are verses in the Bible that are meant to exhort. There are verses in the Bible that are meant to encourage. There are verses in the Bible that are meant to give hope, and there are lots of verses in the Bible that are meant to warn. And I believe that a lot of what we see in this account is just a warning. And we should take it that way. We should take it as a warning of where we could end up and how small little steps can suddenly become giant leaps away from God if we allow ourselves just to take small little steps in the beginning. How quickly the steps become further and further away from God. And it's like you're walking down a pathway with God, nice straight pathway, and on either side is not just another path to take. It's a drop-off of a cliff. And sometimes you can think you can just kind of, you know, I'll never forget when Amber and I drove out to the Pacific Northwest, and then we went down and went in Yosemite, and you're driving through some of those roads and you just look and you're thinking, oh, man, it's the most unnerving thing to drive in that area. And that's what I think of when I look at Judges. I think of that application, that there's a road and there's a path and the lines are clear and you can drive in between the lines and stay right there, and you can get to your destination. But if you start drifting, and you think that you can hang on the curb and on the shoulder just a little bit, there is a dangerous cliff right there waiting for you. And so make sure that you're staying between the lines. So let's get into the readings for today, for this week, and talk about the events of the story. So in chapter 19, where do we start? What do we learn right away in chapter 19? What is the setting for our story? Yes, so before we even get into the characters and the places and all those details of the story, it sets up right away, I think, how we're going to kind of bookend this study. So you notice right there in chapter 19, verse 1, it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel. And we've seen that several times already in the last several chapters that we've looked at, right? This statement, there was no king in Israel, and what? Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so that emphasis is starting to be made in the last three or four chapters, beginning chapter 17 is where you see, I believe, one of the first statements of this being made. Okay, and then you'll notice, how does the book of Judges close? What's the very last thing that's said in chapter 21, verse 25? Somebody read verse 25. 21, 25. Judges chapter 21, 25. Okay, so we close the book with that statement. There's no king in Israel. Everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. Let's unpack that statement again. I know we've done this a couple times just recently. Why is that statement being repeated so much? Is it because Israel needs a king, first of all? Is that what the point of this being stated or recorded for us? Is that the point? Millie's shaking her head. No, I'm seeing some no's. Yeah, what did you say, Aaron?
I think the point was that Israel was failing to submit to the king that they had. To submit to the kingship of Judah. And so they needed a king.
Okay. So, yeah, go ahead.
In the Hebrew Bible, it goes, I believe, straight from Judges to Samuel. And so the author of Judges is called the author of Samuel. Maybe you can call it either way, right? So the author of Judges keeps talking about no king. Well, there was never a king in Israel. God had established tribes and Levites that would keep order and discipline according to God's will. When you get to Samuel, you find them wanting a king, wanting to be like all the other nations around them. And Samuel says, God is a king. So that's just like you hear, according to the Hebrew Bible, you hear there was no king, there was no king four times. And then you see Samuel say, God is a king.
Absolutely. Anything else about that statement? So is the statement, everyone did what was right in his own eyes because there was no king, or is it just two separate statements? There was no king in Israel and everybody was doing what was right in their own eyes. I believe what we're seeing here is two separate statements. It's not saying that everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes because they didn't have a king, because they didn't have anybody to follow, because they didn't know what was right, they didn't have a standard, they didn't have a leader, they didn't have a law to follow. I don't think that's the point of that statement. The point is that there's no king in Israel, and everybody's just doing whatever they want, and it's not because there's not a king, it's just that's how the people are viewing this. They're looking at it as the nations around them have these kings. They want a king, and so they're just kind of doing whatever they want. They're just following their own hearts. We talked a lot about that last Wednesday with Samson, right? That he had given his heart to Delilah. Okay? The people here are following their own hearts. They're just following their own hearts. They're doing whatever they please, whatever comes into their heart. That must be what's right because, well, that's how I feel about this. That's what I think about this. And that's what I think this situation dictates. It dictates this response or this from me and my life. And that's how I'm going to view it. Instead of viewing God as a standard and basing everything about our lives based off what we know about God and what we read about God and what God has told us, we're just kind of doing whatever we think is right in the moment. Do we see that today? Everywhere, right? I mean, throughout our society, we see people who are doing what they think is right in their own eyes. And brother, we have to be warned and take the warning that we're not immune to that. We're not immune, and it can creep in among God's people. It can creep into our mindset very quickly. As soon as we start to think, well, what do I really want to be true? And then, you know, we could go try and find some verses that fit what we want to be true, right? Instead of taking things in context, looking to the whole law, trying to find what God intends for us, we can be guilty of that as well. Thoughts or comments about that?
We said this before, but when we they're doing their thing. That was the problem was that they were letting themselves God. They were deciding what was right and wrong.
Absolutely. The problem is not that they did not have a king. That was not their issue. So I do think it's interesting that this story, because I do think the story starts, you know, that we're looking at tonight is clean. It starts 19 through 21. It kind of bookends, right, with those similar statements. There was no king in Israel, and everybody's doing what was right in their own eyes. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 12. We've looked at this again. We've looked at this previously, but let's read this one again. Proverbs chapter 14 verse 12. I don't think we can say this enough. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Okay, so the proverb writer here is warning us: if we start thinking about what we want and the way that we think is right, instead of looking to what we read and we know about God, that way is off the cliff. Okay? It's off the shoulder and down the cliff into Yosemite Valley, if you will. So, chapter 19. Who are our characters in the beginning here of chapter 19? We basically have three characters, and who are they? A Levite, his concubine, and her father. Okay, so we start with three characters. We start with a Levite, his concubine, and her father. And so why does the Levite man go to Bethlehem? It says he's staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim, but he's going to make this trip to Bethlehem. And why does he make this trip? What's happened? She left him. Was it something else I heard? Was that you, sir? To go get his wife back. To go get his concubine back. What specifically does it say? Why does she leave him? Was it being mean? She was not faithful to him. So she was. It says, verse 2, that she played the harlot against him. So there's some kind of sexual sin, it seems to be, that she's committed against him. She's gone back to her father's house, and he's gone to get her. And is he going with force? How is he going to meet up with her and find her?
Appeal to her?
What was it? Kind to her, peaceful to her. So it depends on the translation. It says in verse 3, then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. Okay, so it gives this impression that there's a relationship there between the two of them, that he's being kind to her, that he wants her back, that he values their relationship. It is kind of how this story begins. So what happens while he's there in Bethlehem? Yeah. How does her father respond to him coming to get his daughter? Seems to be all on board with that, right? In verse 4, glad to meet him, brings him back to his house, and as Nathan said, he doesn't want him to leave, right? In fact, how long does he end up staying there? How long?
3 days.
I saw, stay with him 3 days, okay. And then in 3 days in verse 4, then this is on the fifth day. So whether that's when he leaves and then when he's departing, if it's 3 days in between, I'm not sure. But he stays with him an extended amount of time, right? And each time that he's going to leave, what does the father-in-law say? Hold on, just stay one more day. All right, we're having a good time. So it seems to be that this is a very positive trip. He's gone to get his concubine back. He's gone there peacefully, kindly, seeming to kind of reform this relationship. The father-in-law is very open to him. He's very hospitable to this Levite, brings him into his home, entertains him, wants him to stay, and then finally he departs. Why do you think we have so much said about their stay there and this relationship between the Levite, the concubine, the father-in-law? I mean, we have 10 verses, roughly, about this interaction. You think there's a significance to that? I thought a lot about that yesterday and struggled. I struggled a lot with that. So Danny was saying that maybe the point of this is just to show that time and chance, this idea of time and chance, and how things play out sometimes in ways that we wouldn't and wouldn't anticipate. Knowing what we know, let's discuss that a little bit. Knowing what we know about how this story unfolds, how do you think her father-in-law felt in chapter 20? How do you think her father, not her father-in-law, her dad, felt about this? This is the part I struggle with. When I made this connection over the last couple of days, and yesterday I thought a lot about it, and when I was reading it, I was just kind of going through and thinking about, and I put myself in the place of this father. So he has this daughter who's a concubine for a Levite and has sinned against him and been unfaithful. And it seems like the relationship is restored. He's forming this bond with her husband, with this Levite. He encourages him to stay, longer. Oh, we're having such a good time. Finally, he departs, and then this horrible story unfolds. And as a result, his daughter is brutally handled. And so it was very difficult for me in the last couple of days to read this and not put myself in the place of that father. That if maybe he could have convinced the Levite to stay just for one more day, maybe if he'd have gotten him to leave in the morning or a little earlier so he didn't have to stop in Gibeah. Maybe if he would have had him leave a day earlier. What might have happened and how that story could have changed. And maybe just the guilt that the father possibly felt from this. I'm surely felt from this. And I know we've all probably been in situations where we've questioned or we felt guilt about a situation. What if I'd have just done this? What if I would have just said this? What if I would have just turned around? What if I would have done something just a little different? And what could have been the result? How the story could have changed? I don't think that's necessarily the point of the story that we have here in 19 through 21, but I do think it's something that, as I read through, I couldn't help but think about that and let that dwell in my mind a little bit. Does anybody else have it? Yeah, Danny.
Talk about that. You see
see it in the beginning of Genesis, where the downward spiral is always looking for, so big that only one to save, right? And then you see it at a grander scale after the book of Genesis, when you have the kings and God allows them to try it that way, and so they go into exile because of the wickedness of that. Between the father-in-law story and then the story as it continues in verse 22, those both remind me of Genesis. So the same thing happened to Jacob, where the Rachel and Leah were used to delay his partner. He was tricked, right? Deception was a huge part of the whole Jacob story, from him to how he was deceived and whatnot throughout that story. It also reminds me, when the previous story said it on Sunday of James, where they thought that I had a Levite in my house, now I'm out of his favor. Right? So maybe he's just saying that. And then starting in verse 22, it sounds a lot like the Lot story, where it's like, no, evil men come to the house and he says, take my daughter, right? It's almost verbatim. I mean, there's some different details. But how sinful was that situation where Sodom and Gomorrah had to be destroyed because Lot and his family were righteous? And so it's maybe the writer of Judges is telling a story in such a way that should remind us back, hyperlink, if you will, back to those Genesis stories and see the spiral of the
Mm-hmm. And we do know from Genesis that the people of God pulled themselves out of a spiral, and we see that at the end of Joshua, their commitment to the Lord, they're at their seemingly highest level. They're at the greatest generation, if you will. They've just conquered the land of Canaan, and they're dividing it up, and they're making this commitment, and then how quickly they go into what we see in Judges chapter 19. So, building off this, let's build off the Levite, okay? So, as Nathan pointed out in the last class, and how there was this Levite who was kind of misusing his place, taking advantage of his position as a Levite in this previous chapter, previous couple of chapters of Judges. Who is the priest at this time? I think I asked this later on, maybe in one of the later questions. It was definitely in my notes. No, who's the priest at this time? I know I'm kind of jumping towards the end of the story, but who's the Levite priest? Phinehas. Okay, so when did Phinehas come into the story of what's going on in God's people? Who is Phinehas? He's Aaron's grandson, right? So when did Phinehas kind of get into his position as priest? Where did we first kind of get introduced to Phinehas? Does anybody remember? I mean, we see Phinehas as they're entering the land. Do we not? Or is it the beginning of Joshua? I cannot find my notes. Numbers, there we go. Numbers what? Okay. Yeah, 25:7. So when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand. This is when Israel played the harlot in Moab, right? So we see Phinehas quite a ways back. So there's some commentary that talks about how this story of Judges is actually earlier in the narrative than at the end. But it's quite possible that this happened quite a bit earlier in the book of Judges. Because if you see some of the timeline that pans out, especially with the length of how long the judges ruled, that it's quite possible that this is not a very long time away from Numbers chapter 25. Okay, so it's possible that they got to this point even earlier in their dwelling in the land of Canaan. We also know that the Levites misuse their position when we see at the beginning of the book of Samuel. Why do the people want a king at the beginning of Samuel? A nation around them had one, and then what was another reason? There was another kind of... Samuel's sons were corrupt. So these people who were supposed to be religious leaders are being corrupt around them. So the people of Israel are also seeing the people who should be leading them and setting the right example deteriorating as well. And so when that happens, when the people who should be leading God's people and standing up for what's right, instead of being like Joshua and Caleb, they are taking advantage, as we saw from Nathan's study on Sunday. They're taking advantage of the people for gain, or they're not living as they should. And so I can imagine that the view of the Levites is probably not great. In fact, first of all, why does the Levite end up staying in Gibeah? Why does the Levite man decide to travel to Gibeah? What is his reasoning that we see in chapter 19 of Judges?
He wants to stop in a foreign city.
Right. He doesn't want to stop in a foreign city because he's afraid, well, if I stop among foreigners, something bad might happen. I want to go to a city of God's people. But what happens when he gets there first? When he first gets there, how is he received? Not. He's not received. What's significant about that? Two things, really. I mean, but what, it could be either one. What's significant about the fact that he travels into Gibeah, a city of God's people, seemingly of God's people, and he's not received, he's not given any place to stay? To each other, yeah. To foreigners as well. And even more specifically, let's look back over to Deuteronomy chapter 14. Deuteronomy chapter 14, starting in verse 27. You shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe. So, in verse 29, and the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates, may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So they were to be hospitable. They were to take care of the Levites. We see that over again in chapter 12 of Deuteronomy as well, in verse 19. Similar language, but they were not to neglect the Levites. They were on the same, in the same kind of category as the fatherless and the widows, okay? Because they did not have a portion of the inheritance. So the implication here is that the Levite views Gibeah as a place that's safe. It's his people. He goes specifically there because he is afraid, possibly of staying in a city of foreigners. And quite frankly, he should feel this way. He should feel safe. Based off what we see in Deuteronomy and the instructions that are given, he should be open. He should be welcomed with open arms, right? Taken in, fed. But he's not. And in fact, what does he bring with him? He even says, I have what?
Provisions for himself.
I have provisions for me. For everybody who's with me, and even for my donkey, I don't even need straw. I literally just need a place to come in and lie down for the night and sleep, and then I'll be on my way the next day. I have everything that I need. I don't need anything from anybody. And he's at the point where he's sleeping in the city square. So so we see a man comes and offers to take him in. It's described as an old man. Verse 16, just then an old man came in from his work in the field at the evening, who also was from the mountains of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. So he's not even from there, but he has a place to stay, and he's inviting the Levite in. Okay, I have a place to stay. You shouldn't sleep on the street. That's crazy. Come in and you can stay with me tonight. Yeah.
doesn't talk about any interaction. So was there some physical attribute that he would know my psychic is because that's what I was, how would you know that? We're not told that
discussion about it. No, so is there any way to know that he's a Levite? No, and in fact, in verse 17, when the old man sees him, he sees him as what? A traveler, right? When he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going and where do you come from?" So it kind of reminds me of that verse in Hebrews talking about, you know, by entertaining strangers, sometimes we've unwittingly been hospitable to angels. You know, if people were doing what they were supposed to do, when they saw this traveler just at the close of day in the open square with no place to stay and nobody's helping them, maybe they could have been unwittingly helping a Levite like they should have been, right? And so, there's no indication that anybody knew that. But certainly, seeing a traveler there. No, you did not miss anything there. Any other comments on that before we get into the atrocity?
It's interesting to think why didn't they extend hospitality? Perhaps they knew themselves and projected on this man what they would have done.
Certainly. So how does the story unfold? Let's start reading in verse 22. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally." But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now, humble them, and do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing." But the men would not heed him. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine, fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up and let us be going." There was no answer. So the man lifted her up on the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. Then he entered his house. He took a knife, laid hold of the concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And so it was, all who saw it said, "No such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." How would you describe the actions of the Levite and the host here in chapter 19? How would you describe the either one? How about the master of the house? He's right in his own eyes. Why do you think he's right in his own eyes? What did he surmise out of this situation? That one thing is better than another, right? That this is better than that. And so that. What about in another situation? Maybe this might be better than that. Or this might be better than that. Or that might be better than this. And so Wade makes a great point. he's doing what's right in his own eyes. I mean, we don't need to talk about the perverted men. I mean, I think we all fully have something in mind for the perverted men, right? But how? But I do want to think about the master of the house and the Levite and how they're reacting. And I think, again, Wade makes a very good point. They're doing what's right in their own eyes. He is justifying his decision because he's thinking, well, this sin is better than this sin or not as bad as this sin. And he's equating these things in his mind. But what's happening? He's a coward. I think that's exactly right. It's cowardly. It's cowardly. He thinks he's doing the right thing. He's making one sin worse or better than another. And okay, to a degree, there might be some point to this. But ultimately, he's a coward. Who else is a coward? The Levite, right? Because the way I read this, the master of the house is saying, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. He's speaking there. 25, the men would not heed him, so the man took his concubine. This is the Levite. And opens the door, here you go. Closes the door. This woman who he seemingly had this kind, thoughtful relationship with at the beginning of chapter 19... Well, when the cards are on the table, it doesn't seem that that was truly how he felt about her and how he valued her. And so he is quick to let her be the scapegoat in this situation. And then how does he react? I mean, he's cowardly in the night. How does he react the next morning? Opens the door and sees her there. Get up. Let's go. I mean, if it doesn't stir you, then wake up. Because I just feel the blood boiling. Get up. Let's be going. And then he gets back and he decides he's going to send a message. He's going to send a message to all of Israel. Well, here's what happens. So he dismembers her into 12 pieces and sends a piece to each tribe. I have no idea what he's thinking when he does this. I have no idea. He's doing, as Wade said, he's doing what's right in his own eyes.
Cowardly, but may also be just selfish.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't want to make this about the Levite either, because this is about the men of Gibeah. Absolutely. Nathan, and then Lita, see you after that.
Yeah. He's cowardly and he's selfish. And there's no way around that. I mean, possibly he just was weighing on his conscience. I mean, he literally pushed her out the door. And then, you know, even how he conveniently leaves that detail out of the story in chapter 20 when he's saying what actually happened. It makes him look so innocent and honest. And he doesn't seem so upset about the fact that there was such sin in this whole story as it is about just giving personal revenge and feeling personally feeling better.
Lee?
Pretty correct. It's to me.
Is it any different now, Jeremiah?
Throughout the story, you see one bad thing happen after another, right? From her playing the harlot and not taking in Levi. But instead of somebody stopping the trend, the upward, the downward trend, right? So escalates quickly, but it's spiraling down. They remain evil with more evil. It gets worse and worse and worse. You almost lose the whole tribe because of this. So nobody breaks the cycle. And this is a perfect opportunity for the Levite to break the cycle and say, nope, this is what's right in God's eyes, not in my eyes. This is what's right.
Yeah, which brings up a nice segue there. So how does Israel react to the events? How does the nation of Israel, when the Levite sends these 12 body parts around to the tribes, how does Israel react? What's their reaction? What verse is that? Verse 7. Look, all of you who are children of Israel, give your advice and counsel here now. So all the people arose as one man. They're all together saying, none of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now, this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. So they're ready to go. They're fired up. There's one voice. Let's go. We're taking care of this. How does the tribe of Benjamin react to that? Because the people of Israel, they want to go to Gibeah. And what do they want when they get to Gibeah? They want the men who did this crime against this woman. They want the men who did the crime. Verse 13, now therefore deliver up the men, the perverted men who were in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. But what? How does Benjamin react? Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. So we have Israel fired up, ready to go, ready for vengeance, ready to repay, and Gibeah, Benjamin being defensive, right? Being defensive. When do they inquire of the Lord? When do they seek the counsel of the Lord?
After they decided what they were going to do.
And when specifically? When they're at the threshold of battle. They're basically, they're already lined up. They're already ready to go. They're at the beginning of the war. Who's going to go first, God? We've already decided what we're going to do. Tell us who's going to do it first now. Help us decide which one's going to go first. So they don't even know who's going to go first yet. But they've already decided quite a bit. Let's go get the men of Gibeah. All right, they don't want to send out the men of Gibeah. Benjamin wants to protect them. Well, let's go to war then. What else did they decide in that time before they sought the counsel of the Lord? We find out later in chapter 21, right? Or is it the end of 20? 21. What else had they done? They made a vow. We're never going to do what? We're never going to give our women to the tribe of Benjamin. Another sticky situation that we see them have to pull back and figure out, like, oh no. Well, now that we've wiped out the tribe of Benjamin, We kind of need them to have something to rebuild from, and we've just made this vow. Who wasn't there for the vow? And then they're kind of who? So they've already taken three pretty drastic steps in going after this before they even asked the Lord, "What should we do?" If only they'd had a king, though, right, to tell them what to do. This whole mess would have been just perfect, right? It would have been just fine. If they had had a king that told them, hey, you should go and you should do this and this is how we should handle it, then they would have been fine. But no, they made three big decisions as one. Just think if they would have just come together as one for good at some point. Let's get rid of the idols. Let's get rid of the inhabitants of the land as one. Hey, we lost track. Let's come together as one. Remember why we're here. Remember what we're supposed to be doing. Come together as one. Unity. And that's the call for us today. Unity. Come together as one. And when we don't, and everybody's doing kind of their what's right in their own eyes, and we're not one in Christ, with God as the head, Christ as our King, then it's easy to go down the same path of doing what's right in our own eyes. So again, an atrocity is committed. A tribe is virtually wiped out. And we see a very low point for the people of Israel here at the close of Judges. And the story is going to continue into Samuel as well for next quarter. Any other final comments? We're a minute past, but just thank you all for your participation on such a challenging topic and a challenging story to get through, for sure.